So I'd like to just kind of single out some of the things about the food crisis in terms of keeping people healthy, keeping them well fed, and looking at the world situation and looking at some of the trends that seem to be important at the present time. And kind of to summarize the present situation then, one of the concerns in relationship to food is a climatic shift. Now we don't know how important this is at the present time, but actually worldwide the climate has been getting colder since 1955, and that trend is continuing right up to the present, and it has not changed significantly yet. So we're still in the cold part of a climatic cycle. And this being the case, this has an impact then on the productivity of land areas in certain parts of the world. And we've had some shifts, and one of the most dramatic shifts is in the Sahara and the Sahara Desert, and it has specifically affected very important segments of the African continent. And it has changed the rain cycles in some place, so that some places are getting too much rain, other places are not getting enough. And so the climatic cycle shift is an important thing. And what has happened with the increase in population, and that's one of the major trends that we have to look at. And with the increase in population, naturally the food frontiers have been sought out. So while we had a very favorable climatic shift prior to 1955, and from 1945 to 1955 was when the big influx, one of the most dramatic changes in food availability and in population increase. And then the population could increase simply because they could move into areas and make them productive. And so they moved into the Sahara, for example, which was normally a desert area, but they moved in and were able to get enough food. And so then when the climate began to shift back, then there was starvation, and very important segments of people were affected by this. So that those two things working together. The miracle seeds are an important thing to look at too. The hybrid kind of thing. So that agriculture has provided much more food per unit acre as a result of the miracle seeds. Now this is an important trend because it provides a lot more food per acre, and so as people are dependent on food, and if we can continue this trend, that's great. But this trend also needs examination, because the miracle seeds are produced from the natural seeds by certain combinations. And as long as you leave nature to operate in the way nature has operated for millions of years, it continues to produce new varieties. But to the degree that you begin to limit the availability of nature to produce the natural kinds of variations within the seeds, then you begin to restrict the potential for producing the varieties that will do best within a certain climate. Now, what man is capable of doing, and what he does very effectively, is to segregate out those characteristics of seeds which are most productive in a given climate, in a given kind of situation. And so we have specialized to the point that if there is any change that's introduced, then it becomes a very serious kind of thing, because the change wipes out a large part of our crop, and it wipes out the potential for nature to generate the kinds of diversity that we need. We are no longer in a position where we can feed the world without these miracle seeds. And the question is whether or not we can continue this, and whether we are capable of picking just the right thing so that we can keep in phase with nature's changes in terms of climatic shifts, and in terms of other things. And some of these other things that are of concern are the insects and the pesticides, you see. We control to get maximum crops by using a lot of pesticides. And the pesticides worldwide now are man-made, and these are kinds of things that are can be used very specifically to get a greater crop at a certain time. But the question is, what are we doing to the balance in nature and to the variety of things that can accumulate? As soon as you change one thing in a system, you begin to affect the change within the whole system. And we are the guinea pigs, in a sense, because we don't know exactly how this is all going to come out. And those are the kinds of things we have to worry about. Well, okay, so much for some of these major trends, then, that bear examination. I want to just point out that the world surplus of food built up from 1945 to 1970. And you're well aware of that. Everywhere you drove across this fertile land of North America, you found the granaries being built and being filled. And we had a real problem in storing grain, because we couldn't store everything we could raise. And so we gave no concern to any of these trends, because it looked like the granaries were full, we had more than we could use, we could provide not only ourselves, but the rest of the world. This whole picture has dramatically changed now as a result of climatic shifts and population growth. These two things, and that is as the major thing. So by 1972, the world surplus was really almost non-existent. And as you come down to the present time, we have the lowest surplus that we've had in certainly within any recent time, within the last several tens of years. And now the granaries are not full. And it's estimated now that we have something like a 22-day reserve of food, you know, in terms of the world. And that is the lowest it has been for a long, long period of time. In 1961, for example, instead of this kind of a figure of, say, within the 20 days, we had a 90-plus day reserve, almost a 100-day reserve, and so on. Now, what has this done in terms of our supply of food to the world? It has caused us to reduce our aid programs. And specifically, within the last few years, we have reduced our aid to foreign countries. Where they could buy it and pay for it, we've had it available to sell. And we have exported it where it seemed that there was some good reason for us to export it. But just to have it to give away, you know, we've reduced the aid programs because of some things. We've had a shortage in our own crops. Up until last year, we had a good crop, and it looks like maybe this year we're going to have another good crop. But basically, our crops have been affected by these climatic shifts as well. Now, if you realize that population increases at 75 million per year, 75 million more mouths to feed each year, 30 million are now starving. It is in the category where you can say that their food is at the starvation ration. 500 million are suffering from hunger in the world as you look at it in total. And this was the kind of thing that really surfaced very prominently in the Bucharest World Food Conference. The United Nations, you see, met to consider the world food problem in 1974, August of 74. And this is the picture that they came up. In the recent conference that we had, the United Nations conference, which was a follow-up of this, in Vancouver the first 2 weeks in June, again, these kinds of figures were coming to the surface, that the population increase and the food deficit, the starving peoples in many parts of the world, and so on. So it has not changed. Now, the arable land, I think, is an important thing to look at. How many acres are there available, you see, to man in terms of the present population? As you look at it worldwide, there is 1 acre per person, as you look at it worldwide, that's available, that can raise food, arable, meaning that it's you can produce a crop on it. 1 acre per person. Now, one of the basic questions is, when we double the population, and the present feeling is that the world population will double in 30 years. And this was kind of assumed as a base for the conference and Habitat in the last one up in Vancouver. So that the assumption is that we're going to have 2 people for every 1 that we have now in 30 years. Now, you younger people, this is all within your lifetime. There'll be 2. So we cut that acreage from 1 acre to 1/2 acre available. And that's if you just assume that all of the acres that we now have can be retained. But the other problem is that as more people populate the earth, more of the land is taken up in various ways by shopping districts, by simply putting a house down. You cover up a certain part of your acre that you have left. So when you figure that you have to be housed and you have to have all the services that go with, the arable land is one of the critical things in the world picture. How are we going to retain it? Are we going to move our houses to the areas where the arable land is not taken out of the picture? In other words, moving them up on the slopes where you can't farm. But you see, the developers naturally picked the nice flat agricultural area, and so as you look at the cities, what's being used is the place where you can also build the cheapest. And we have not really concerned ourselves with land use from the point of view of reducing the arable acreage trend, which is a very, very serious problem when you come right down to it. Now, it's important to note that with the miracle seeds and the Green Revolution, we have increased the productivity of the acreage that is available, and actually farmland has increased substantially because we have moved into areas and redeemed it, in a sense, by irrigation and various other ways, so that there's been a substantial increase in the amount of acres that we have been able to farm that way. And we've also increased the yield per acre by at least a third, 35% roughly, so that an acre now worldwide will produce more, because of the seeds and the fertilizer. And so the grain production has dramatically increased from, say, World War II to the present time. And that is really where we have pinned our hopes, you see, in that we can continue the productivity of each acre, keeping it going on up. As a boy, I was raised on a farm in Iowa. And in southeast Iowa, we figured that if on the average you got a grain crop, a corn crop of 50 bushels per acre or 60, this was a good crop when I was a youngster. Now those same acres will produce at least 3 times that much. If you don't get well over 100 bushel per acre, you know, it's not even a normal crop. So the Green Revolution has brought this on. Fertilizers are an important part of this, and pesticides have controlled the bugs, and the fertilizer has increased the yield. And all of these things have become very important. The thing I would point out is that in the areas where food is most critical, these kinds of things are not really helping us out to the degree that they should, because In India, for example, the fertilizers are becoming too expensive. The people cannot afford to buy them. And it's a question now of whether we provide the fertilizers in order that they then can raise the food, or whether we ship our surpluses, you see, to other parts of the world. Now, it's important, I think, that we realize that the United States is the chief food exporter in the world. That is, we have the capacity to produce the most food and export it, the net exportable amount, and we export in addition more than 41% of our crop. Actually, in 1974, 41% of our total crop was exported. It was more than what we needed, you see, and we could do that. And we've given more than $25 billion in food since 1954. So it isn't that the United States has not done a lot and continues to do a lot, but it's a question of doing this into the future. Now, if you look at what it takes to feed a human being in the developing countries versus our own developed country, this is a dramatic figure. And actually, a person in China or in India or in these areas basically can live on 400 pounds of grain per year. 400 pounds of grain per year. And that's, you see, 365 days, so a little over a pound of grain per day. Now, in our country and Europe and the developed countries, the equivalency is 2,000 pounds of grain per year per person. So 2,000 as against 400, you see. This is the consumption as it is today in the United States, Europe, and the developed countries, you see, of the world. And one of the concerns people have, and we have, is what it takes to produce other foods. Now, we don't basically live on a grain diet. See, we don't like to just have rice or wheat. We eat a lot of wheat here because they make the bread so good that you can't help it eat it, you know, and that's great, and I hope we continue. But what does it take to produce these things? The grain needed to produce one loaf of white bread is about 9/10 of a pound of grain for the normal loaf. And to produce a gallon of milk, we like milk, it takes about 2.8 pounds of grain to produce a gallon of milk. And it takes to produce 1 pound of poultry, chicken or turkey, 3 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of that kind of food. To produce a dozen eggs takes about 4.25 pounds of grain to produce a dozen eggs. And a pound of pork, it takes 6+ pounds of grain to produce a pound of pork. And then when you get to beefsteak, takes 20 pounds of grain to produce a pound of beefsteak. So you see, here's where the differences come in. We like meat, you know, and we're a high protein diet kind of people with beefsteak and pork chops, you see, and this kind of thing. This is what it takes. Now, I think it's important to point out another thing here before, and then I'll let you comment, because I don't want to leave it right here, because beef, you know, you have to look at beef and mutton in another way. That is, cattle are very efficient, ruminant kinds of animals. They can produce beef from things other than grain, and that's a very important thing. That is, they can eat the grass, and they can eat various kinds of food that really is not a grain-producing food in the same sense. And they're very efficient at producing high-protein food in that way. And so we have to look at, if you don't grain feed beef, then you still get a lot of beef for food, but it has a different quality. And as long as we're willing to accept the difference in quality, then this is the kind of thing that I think that, you know, we shouldn't just think of just getting away with beef as a food source, but we ought to think of it in terms of not so much grain-fed, feedlot kind of beef, you see, which has become really the standard. And so our, when we market in the store, you see, as to standards, you see, it's related to this kind of grain-fed beef. And so when you want to buy the choice, you see, it relates to these kinds of figures. Now, yeah.
Yeah, that's related to what I was going to ask. How much of our beef is, in fact, beef that has been raised with grain?
In the United States.
Yeah. In other words, yeah, I hear that it takes 20 pounds of wheat to
produce a pound.
One pound of beef. Yeah. But in fact, how is most of our beef poundage developed?
Well, statistically, I can't really give you the figures, but basically 70%. I think you know, huh?
70%.
70%.
Small
plants. Yeah.
Is from grain. Only 30% grass fed.
30% grass fed. 70% grain fed.
And the figure for beef as a whole would be closer to the figure I have is 8.7 for the
overall average.
Overall.
Okay. It's still at the top of the list, right, Al?
Right.
Yeah, still at the top of the list, but not 20 pounds.
Not
I think it's not
dramatic.
The right. Not quite the way.
It's dramatic enough.
Right. Okay. Now, wheat prices, as you know, have gone up, and grain prices generally, of course, have gone up, and this is another thing. Now, another way of looking at it is the food consumed by 210 million Americans would feed in their normal diet 1,500,000,000 Chinese. In other words, take their diet versus ours. What would feed 210 million would feed 1,500 million. See, so it's a dramatic difference in the diets that we have. And there, you see, when you look at food as energy, and just reduce it to that, you can pretty well figure it in terms of grain consumption. And in terms of grain consumption, about 1/5 of the energy to feed mankind worldwide comes from rice. And about almost another 1/5 of the energy provided by grain comes from wheat. Corn then comes down the list quite a little ways, but it's again the next. And then you look at various other kinds of food, potatoes and various other things. But the two important ingredients in feeding the world are rice and wheat, and then corn would be next. And rice, of course, is the dominant food of the underdeveloped world. And this is essentially 3/4 of the population of the world. So that most of the people of the world have this as their diet, and the rest of the world consumes a lot more, and they are more generally on a wheat and corn diet. You see, that's basically what we are in this country. We're one of the great exporters of rice. We just don't eat it, you know. We raise it, but we eat very little of it. So we can export rice, and we also, of course, export wheat, and we export corn. Now, it really comes right down to a race between the stork and the plow. And that's pretty much where it is, because the population is increasing in the developing world so rapidly, and the plow really isn't able to keep up with this kind of a population increase. So where is the food going to come from? There is food available when you look at it on a balance of the world at large, and the greatest source of food for the developing world is the United States.
Now, Rudy, one figure I saw was that you could feed 16 billion people on the present food intake if you had the Chinese diet?
If you had the Chinese diet.
In terms of calories.
Yeah.
Protein.
Yeah. Yes, so that we can't say that there is a shortage of food in the world, right?
In terms of
that kind of a diet, if you look at it from the point of view of the Chinese diet. I just saw a lot of Chinese pictures, which were made in China, and of course they were designed to present the Chinese point of view, and that's understandable, but still the people were there, and you could look at them, they looked well fed. You know, they didn't look emaciated, and you could see that they were well fed. And so this diet, you know, will sustain life in a very adequate situation. Yes?
Another interesting statistic, I don't have that with me, but I know it's someplace in everybody's house too, is the percentage of our grain that is converted into alcoholic beverages and therefore is not used as food.
Alcohol is food.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's not that efficient, but it is food.
It is a food, if you want to look at it that way, but it's probably not the best conversion.
I could bear witness one more thing there. The gusto was non disputandum est, as they say, you know, but you can't argue about taste, but rice never becomes wearisome, even for people not used to it. No one in our prison camp wearied of rice.
Yeah.
Corn, on the other hand, you become quickly satiated with it. It's a different kind of a picture. And that was true for all of us in prison. People had to get tired of rice. We never did.
No.
And the nice thing about rice is a little bit of something. I can't stand garlic now, but then a tiny twig of garlic in your rice, and that was it.
Good for your heart also.
Yeah, garlic. Yeah, here's another comment.
Is our country necessarily the greatest food producer? If other countries had our agricultural, our farming methods, could they become more efficient, or don't they have the space, or what?
Yeah, I think it's not a question of efficiency of producing food so much, because you take it the intensive kind of agriculture that goes on in India, they get a maximum amount of food out of the kind out of their acre, you know, so to speak. And it's an intensive kind of farming. Now, what we do with fertilizers and machinery, you see, and increasing with the miracle seeds and all, we do increase this very substantially. But it's not exportable. That's the point. And this is basically what we have tried to do. We have tried to tell India that what you need is a John Deere tractor and a plow and the kind of fertilizer we use, and then you do it the way we do it. But this really is not an exportable kind of thing. And so I think basically the answer to your question is that the efficiency can be produced mainly through continuing it as a labor-intensive kind of thing, rather than a capital-intensive kind of thing. Rather than buying tractors and plows in India, if they could spend that money in producing fertilizer. And basically what they ought to be able to do is to produce it in their own country rather than getting it from us. And one of the greatest problems is in distribution of food, because we can grow it and raise it in surplus, but to transport food is a very perishable kind of thing. And I'll never forget the food that I rode with, you know, when I was in Guatemala at different times, and the United States government was giving grain, mainly corn, to the Guatemalans, and it was coming in and being sent out in burlap sacks, you know, marked corn, and in essence it said gift of the United States. And I saw some of that corn. You know, I rode with it on planes out to the Petén area and to the Indians of Guatemala. And I saw it unloaded, and I saw wherever there was a hole in a sack, that grain was absolutely wormy. It's grain you would not touch. And yet it was coming with the label of the United States on it, and I don't know what they did with it, but I'm sure they ate it all.
Including the world.
Including, no doubt. But that grain is a very perishable thing to distribute, particularly in the tropical climates.
This report says that if India used our methods, they'd produce 230 metric tons as opposed to their current 100. If they used Japanese methods, they'd produce 350 million metric tons as opposed to their 100 tons now. Mm-hmm.
Was the Japanese method a labor intensive? It is.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Japan has done a lot of things like extending the growing season by cultivating the rice seedlings and hothouses and all sorts of things like that. So they've really, it's technological ingenuity also.
Yeah.
And using every square inch of land.
Right. And the thing that kept being emphasized at the Vancouver conference is the appropriate technology. Now, there are certain technologies, you see, which Japan has been able to use in terms of food that are very helpful. Now, there are certain technologies, you see, which Japan has been able to use in terms of food that are very helpful. And India is beginning to learn these technologies. And they're basically the kinds of technology that they can produce within their own culture if they know how. And so there's a great deal of help that can be given by the developed world and we in our technological framework, you see. But we can't expect to just transport or just send our own kind of technology over there because our technology is capital intensive. The farmer today puts in thousands and thousands of dollars into machinery, you see, in order to produce these crops that we produce in the Midwest. And it's very highly capital and energy in the sense of oil consumption and so on, and fertilizer consumption. This is not the way to go in the developing countries. Yeah?
Is the figure of doubling the world's population in 30 years related to our present projections, or are there factors injected into that that might reflect some population control measures?
Even the 30 years reflects the population control measures that are being pushed very hard. China now is actually pushing it from the point of view of a tax. That is, you get a tax break on having children, up to two children. The third child, you get a little, but not very much. And the fourth child costs you in terms of taxes.
But even if you've got, say you level off, so one person was born for every person that died, the age range, like this country, we are leveled off, but we're going to increase from 210 to 260 million simply because of the age, that is, that we have a larger group of people at the population producing.
We have both more young people and more old people. Where the old people are staying alive longer, and we have a bigger bulge of younger people that are in the age of child producing. So even though we're at zero growth, our population will increase for some years before it levels out. And that's...
Yeah. If you took a kind of a very middle-of-the-road stance, by 2050 you'll have 16 billion people in the world. If you take a kind of a very, you're going to have 10 or 12 billion by 2050.
What do we have now?
We have four to one or something like that. You're doubling in 30 years. So if you double, then you got 8, and you double that, you got 16 in 60 years. And if you say, well, if you, you know, if you take a kind of view that that isn't going to happen, that's too pessimistic, you're still going to get 10 or 12. You know, I'd say 10 is a figure you just have to, you'd be crazy not to think of 10 million people by 2050.
One of the things that the geneticists are doing right now that maybe has helped is that they know that the efficiency in which the plant produces food is like a half a percent or 1% of the sunlight energy coming onto it is converted into usable food. Some of the wild varieties are, I think my dad said, are up around 5%, and so they want to get the genes to increase the ability, make crosses to increase the ability of the plant to take sunlight and convert it into usable food. They're working with it.
Now, these are very significant things. These are technologies and scientific applications that are very well transportable in many cases to other countries. And I think our hope is, you know, and I feel there is hope in feeding the world, in spite of the fact that our population is going to go up, and I don't think we in any way can stop that. And I feel that we just have to be able to help them do the things that are going to increase food in their local areas. And it's, I don't think we, as the United States, can look at really being the food producing part of the world for everybody else. Now, China has come a long, long way in changing this around, to the point where they were really starving. And they now are basically a pretty well-fed nation. And they couldn't afford to go the route that we have gone in terms of a high energy and a high capital kind of support base for their people. And so they have just literally, they've abandoned, they've turned their back on it, in essence. And they have governmentally forced it, you see. They simply dictated that that's the way it's going to be.
And were there any Chinese president at the World Habitat Conference?
The Chinese delegation did not come. They had their input from the point of view of films, and they had their input in terms of the written material. And presumably, there was no reason to think they weren't coming. But when the conference opened, they weren't there. Now, why we didn't, I don't know. And I heard a lot of, you know, scuttlebutt, but there's really nothing that really pointed out why they weren't there. And that was bad. 1/5 of all the people in the world are Chinese. And to have a world conference where 1/5 of the people are not represented, you see, is not a world conference.
Is the other aspect, I didn't hear you talking habitation, I bet you dealt with it, but the other aspect of this problem, that space and its effect, was that dealt with as well as food?
Yes, and space mainly, what we're zeroing in on here is arable acres. Space
in terms. That's part of it, because I think psychologically it deals with it too. Now, London was filthy, unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just,
well, habitation.
People living, anybody living like that's going to be producing the same kind of product like they're living.
Yeah.
I'm throwing habit bending down the scoop up anything that's on the ground from around here. It's just unbelievable. And maybe same, the churchyards were the same. I mean, they didn't bother to keep their place, just filthy. But just like people are living together, like they've come to the extreme psychological limit and they've given up.
You see, in China, just for an example, everybody now must plant and raise something. Everybody must do some kind of labor that relates to the production of food and services for the masses. Now, whether that's good or bad, you know, in terms of the way we think about it, you know, the President of the United States must also plant his acre.
See, what do we do about
that?
It?
That's kind of
what
hard.
What do we do about all this?
What do we do about all that? Well, I think that's where everybody ought to contribute here at this point. I think, let me just make one other point, that what the World Food Conference decided we ought to do about it is one thing that we should do is to ensure that there is a surplus that is available in the world for times of adverse climatic conditions when starvation impinges at a very important amount. And what they said was that we should create a granary of 60 to 70 million tons of grain. Now, they didn't ever quite spell out who's going to contribute this. And the major question is, who will contribute to this stockpile? Secondly, who will finance it? And third, who will store it? And fourth, who will control this food? You see, psychologically, this is a very important kind of thing. You see, the Arabs basically have the oil. You look at it, we have the food. They don't have food in that sense. And there are other places where the metals are concentrated. Now, are we going to pit ourselves in the world, one faction against another, and trade out? Or are we going to develop some kind of a system that deals with this? And you see, whenever you begin to talk about a system of this kind, the only place that, you see, we're at the top of the pinnacle in terms of all of this, and it simply means that we come down notches to get with the rest of the world, and that's where the real pinch comes.
You know, Norman Borlaug says that even though they developed the technology, it's very difficult culturally to get certain countries to accept his types and to integrate it. He spends half his time on politics as well as the technology. So that's another barrier we have to overcome.
Right, because they're, from a political point of view, to keep the masses in subjugation, you see, is a very important tactic. And this is one of the main problems.
The question is very real, I think, in our own country, because like Berlin's discussion last night, can democracy survive? All right, we operate on a free enterprise system where people raise what will sell best on the market. For example, if cattle, you know, as we said, grain-fed cattle and so on and so forth are still desirable, that's what you do rather than using your land for just producing the grain, putting the cattle out on the range. And in this system, see, we make our base, our choice on the basis of economic expediency.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in order to really build up a surplus of food of the kind that will be exportable, that might not be the best thing to do economically. So who's going to tell the farmers, okay, we do this, you see? I mean, that isn't the kind of motivation. And I think it's really a political question of how are these decisions to be made. Because I think we, in our natural environment, I think we have to say it's not only our technology. Wouldn't you agree that in the United States, I think we have, as far as our land is concerned, we have been blessed. I mean, we really have the breadbasket of the world also from a geographic viewpoint.
Yes, we do.
As far as the land available, arable land. But it really gets down to a question of how is it going to be used? And who makes that decision?
Yeah, to quantify this, while the world at large has 1 acre per person, when you look at the United States, we each have 2.5 acres of arable land. And really, it's the best arable land in the world. So, by all odds, you see, we have very substantial advantages. And it is not conceivable, you know, hardly, that our population will go up so fast that we couldn't feed our own country. But, you see, we more and more must see ourselves as a part of one world rather than in isolation of one nation.
I think there's some short-run sorts of things, and then there's some long-run. And I separate those by thinking of the long-run as the political and economic transformation of the world. Such that the world takes care of itself, and the short run more in terms of the fact that probably in the next 50 years there'll be anywhere from 250 to 500 million people that starve. Yeah, and that's just a fact. It's just like killing them to let them starve. You might as well shoot them. And so we got a problem of taking care of that starvation. And that's no simple problem, but it's somewhat different from taking care of a process by virtue of which people will be able to take care of themselves, which I think was your point, which involves all kinds of economic and political development. And it's clear China was able to make that transition. Now, what's going to happen in some of the nations? It won't go the way of China, or they don't have the kind of control China has. Now, I think in the short run, for myself at least, and here I think we have to change our diet on the protein chain, and I know there's no simple translation of our not eating things high on the protein chain and people who need it getting it. But one figure I saw, and like all figures, who knows whether it's true or not, if we shifted our beef consumption, of course it had to be beef consumption that's grain fed, we shifted our beef consumption to chicken, one third of our beef consumption to chicken, we get enough grain to feed 100 million people at the you know, minimum kind of diet on grain, and just change one third of our beef consumption. And you can see that if you think that what we eat would feed 1,500,000. That's about 7 times our population now. So that certainly we eat a lot of chicken, but we're going to eat more chicken and fish. Fish.
What was that number? How many more people could you feed?
100 million.
100 million. Yeah.
The figure for 100 million is about 20 million tons of grain. So that to change our diet and then to support those actions that are doing this. And I know of two, Bread for the World and Crop. And I know people in churches that have some of them have gone on fast for 36 hours and given their money to Crop. Some have had special diets and given the savings, that is, they've just had rice or just soup for a meal. One day a week, but there's been a shift to some alternative diet. Partly it's to keep one aware of it, and I know for myself I go up and down on this. If something doesn't keep me aware of it, I go on as life as usual. And I would think every church would have two or three people in it interested in the food problem, just like I think they ought to have two or three interested in energy. And related to Bread for the World, I'm sure that in almost every one of the larger communities in the United States there are Bread for the World groups, and one can get related to it and get a continuing supply of information and thought and continue to bring this into the church. I know you get tired of it, so you've got to do it with some finesse and some sense of not always beating people over the head with it. And groups have done all kinds of things. One group had a dinner, and every third person got a tortilla. Every third person got a tablespoonful of rice, and the others had a full course meal. And then they talked about it.
That's nice.
We had assimilation game in our gym, taking our student body for a dinner, a group, you see. And we divided up the gym in terms of the world. And so we put the Asian group over here, which was a great big number of students, and it turned out that they had a very small part of the total meal, you see. And here was the United States over here with all of the goodies and just a handful of people. What and then we let them
I'm hurrying
come
through
to
this
a settlement.
Because we're supposed to quit.
Yeah, we're supposed
to quit. I've got a few more things I really want to get out.
We can
Arthur Simon now, one of our good Lutherans. Both Paul and Arthur Simon have really good Lutherans. Arthur just gave up everything he'd been ever thinking about doing. He was a minister and is head of Bread for the World, and he has a book. I think it's called Bread for the World. Is that his book?
Yeah.
And it just seems to me that we ought to support him and buy his book, but read it and think about it and spread it. And the Friends have a packet on hunger you can get for a dollar, and I have the address for it. And so that somehow our churches, what it takes is a couple of people in your church attending to this year in and year out, mm-hmm. and helping you attend to it, and a few of the rest of the people sympathetic with it and helping them figure out how to continue to think about this and bring it attention. In our energy group, in our church, we are writing position papers to our church. We've been working for about 5 months now, and we meet Sunday mornings, and we started as a kind of regular group in a part of an adult program for 8 weeks, and then we continue. We're going to keep our church informed with white papers on energy, and we've got a group working on food. And there's no way to attend to this shortly or piecemeal. You have to continue to think about it. And that takes us into the long-term politics of food. And in other words, the savings crop program is terrifically successful and adequate program. Bread for the World, they are providing money for food. But the politics of food is more important. It's not more important, but it's equally important, because the amounts of money that are needed are tremendous. And we have reduced the amount of money that's available to provide food for the rest of the world by about a third in the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. I don't have the exact figures, but it's...
Our aid program. Gone down.
That's a political thing. That's the president and the Congress. Mm-hmm. And the present administration, for some reason or other, because it doesn't want to spend, it's got terrific internal economic problems in terms of balancing its budget, has cut this out. Now, we spend the equivalent of the whole world food program every 14 days for the Defense Department. And it's a question of priorities. Now, the money, we need grain allotted, and we need money to allot that grain. That's a public policy that Congress and the President are responsible for. And somehow we have to keep our churches and our church people on the backs of the people who are determining that. And we have to be informed enough to know a little bit about what it means. But I would say we simply need to give several times as much money for the World Food Program and for the World Economic Development. That's equally important, because some of the studies indicate, and I don't know whether you've got the time or the will, or it's worth spending the money. This Mankind at the Turning Point has a chapter in here on the and some other information on food. And just to read that chapter on the scenarios and what's going to happen in the world just makes you shudder. And their solution is really world economic development, a world system in which you get the rich Arab oil countries and the rich developed nations to put the resources into economic development. One of the scenarios indicates there, if India went toward just providing food without all the supporting economic development, it would be worse off in 25 years than it is now. That is, you can't just give food. You have to provide the wherewithal. You have to provide the irrigation. You have to provide the fertilizer, the pesticides. You really have to provide a whole economic system in which you can buy those things. That is, they have to be able to sell some of their other things in order to buy those things. I really heard a figure the other day from our professor of agriculture at the University of Chicago. He said there's enough gas flared in Saudi Arabia every day to provide for all the fertilizer the whole world would need in 2000 if that gas were made of the fertilizer. All they do is light it and burn it up. Now, you've got to have an economic system which somehow makes use of that gas. It's there, and it's not too far away. Mm-hmm. So, and I would think the stance of the president, candidates on this, and I think actually this takes me back again to the lifestyle that we're involved in, which uses so much of the resources of the world for ourselves, as over against somehow thinking of how we can fit in with a world economic development. So I guess I wanted to get that out.
Okay, in closing, I'd just like to call your attention to another 5 books. I won't read them off here, but they're going to be available, and I'll leave them on the desk in the library just to the left as you go in here, Koinonia. They'll be available to anybody who wants to read them. They all have chapters on food and the problem, as well as energy. And I read different books basically than Al does, and so I think it's important, you know, that we dialogue together, because his reading list and mine always turn out to be a little different, but that's understandable. I come at it from a different point of view. But we're both talking about the same thing, and that's important.
There's one book in the bookstore now. I don't know the book. Do you know Lester Brown's book?
No.
Lester Brown.
I listened to Lester Brown in Vancouver.
Yeah, he's a senior fellow of the Overseas Development Council.
Yeah.
He's written several books on food.
So there's just a tremendous amount of literature that's available in this area to inform people on. And I strongly urge that we get this down to the congregational level. That's where you have an impact. And I try to go during the Sunday school hour to different churches, and I try to talk about this. And our church is actively engaged, and many churches that I know of now are getting. And I think the church does a phenomenal job in the area of food worldwide. That is, there's no overhead.
Especially, though, what it does is to provide a little money for food, and it very seldom gets involved in the political and economic policies.
No, that's right.
Absolutely essential.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Deal with this problem. And sometimes you can get rid of your guilt by giving a little money, as over against the social and economic policies of a nation,
yeah,
which are much...
Even that little you do out of guilt is helpful. We just passed here on Tuesday noon, and nobody kicks, but we don't do it during the summer because we're afraid you people would kick, but
I wish we were.
In spring we do it. Nobody ever kicks, and $50 goes from the then kitty of the village to Bello.
I wish we had some way of doing two things here. One, of calling attention to alternative diets, which the kitchen is giving us. Like we had the barley and the corn the other night,
yeah,
and chicken. Now, Matt, that is a good meal from the point of view of protein.
I don't understand why beef is served here at all. I think it's highly irresponsible. I don't think there's a need for pork to be served here either. We don't need that.
How long do you stay here?
That is not an organic
people meat. Paying $107 a week, and I got to deal with them, and you say it's irresponsible.
Yes.
We wouldn't have a place for you to come to if we did it.
I think it is.
We train the public first, then we'll do it.
Yeah.
No, what are you responding to? A cultural need?
$107 for an adult, he expects to be good when he comes up here.
No.
He's going to take that change of diet, frankly.
What we need to do, you see, if you just suddenly introduce this anywhere, you wouldn't get the educational value. You'd get a lot of reaction, I think. Now, maybe that confrontation would be useful. But if we could have some of our meals representing what we think all of them should be, and talk about it a little, so that there's the educational value. I don't know that people were aware, other than some of us are too aware of it already, of what that meal the other night represented in terms of thoughtfulness about food, you see.
Could you sign up when you came to the village, or say you just made a day of...
That's an angle on Doris's.
And a sitting, and maybe even at once.
Anyone want to join us on that?
Our first sitting could be that
yeah,
you know,
very good talk. That's a possibility.
I think what we need is some committee to think about it with the kitchen, how it could be done in such a way that would take all the aspects into account.
Mm-hmm.
And I think perhaps share the menus, or share the recipes almost for the model meals.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. It's just criminal.
Then you create good guilt for that second group, and they finally go back and work on it when they got home. That's really good.
Well, Rudy, I've been told by nutritionists that with this artificial, particularly chemical fertilizers and hybrid seeds and forcing the land to overproduce according to natural production, that actually the food we're growing now, and particularly in California, does not have the nutrition value that it had under the older methods.
Well, I'm sure there are grounds for this, and I'm not an expert, so I really shouldn't comment on it. I don't know. I've heard the same thing.
You have problems each way you go. Like I wrote today about that January, February, March, half of April for the year after this, and I just asked if we're using Macapala, is our boat going out there that uses wood-burning boilers?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
maybe
so
we
say,
can...
Well, here, and use up the oil to get the game and get up to Hawaii. You know?
Maybe we can encourage everybody to continue to study the problem. And then try to do something about it.